a little bit what we talked about last week, which was the crucifixion of Jesus. And we're right now, we kind of stopped where he's up on the cross. But I wanted to ask you just how three different groups handled this whole sequence of events from the time he began his trial in front of the Sanhedrin to the time he's up on the cross. Let's look at the Sanhedrin or the Jews first. How would you describe their approach to this whole thing?
Unlawful.
Unlawful? Yeah, they were breaking their own law, right? Especially when they were told to stone somebody for blasphemy, and yet they don't even stone them themselves, and they have to send them off to the Romans to be crucified, right? How else would you describe the Jews?
Jealous.
They're very jealous of Jesus, aren't they? Envious. How else would we describe them? Are they persistent? Do they learn very quickly?
No,
they would be considered hard of heart. Their heart is like a rock, isn't it? It's almost impenetrable. Seeing some of the things that Jesus has gone through, and they're watching all of this. Even when Pilate, you know, he scourges Jesus, and Pilate's hoping that the Jews will think this is enough, right? This is enough. He's experienced enough. He's been punished. But yet still, they look at Jesus' condition, and what do they yell? Excuse me. They yell, "Crucify him. Crucify him." I mean, there's just no mercy, is there? So we see one approach there. How about Pilate? How would you describe Pilate in this whole ordeal? Sam? Yeah, he seems to. Definitely seemed like it for the trial of Jesus here. That's what he was trying to do. It seemed like he knew something, right? That there was something greater here that he was a part of. And so he was trying to have integrity in the situation. Joe?
Well, he was a politician.
Yeah.
He didn't think it is.
Yeah. Which is sad, too. That, like you said, a person in authority asking, what is truth? You would hope that they would know what truth is if they have such power, right? But I think politician is a great word to describe him because he would have the mobs and the crowds essentially ordering him and telling him what to do, right? He was scared of the people. He was fearful of them because these people would, they would, you know, have riots and things like that. And so he was very fearful of what they would do if he wasn't to follow what they were telling him to do, right? Andrew? And we saw that too when the Jews had threatened him. Right? Are you a friend? You're not a friend of Caesar's, I think they said something like that, right? And so I would definitely agree on your point there. Sam?
The Jews.
The one who delivered you, yes,
so
exactly. You can also sense some frustration there, you know, with the Jews and their persistence. How about Jesus? So far, what can we say about Jesus in this whole ordeal? The crucifixion, the scourging, the mocking. Meek, yes. Totally under control at all times, right? How else would we describe him?
Determined.
Determined. He was determined to make the plan work, right? Don?
Submissive to God's will,
right? Exactly. And what was his focus on the other people around him, right? It was on the other people around him, wasn't it? Especially we saw the story of his mother standing there, and what does he do?
He tells John.
He makes sure that his mother's taken care of, and this is when he's on the cross. He's suffering the pain that we had talked about, and yet he's thinking about his mother, right? Pretty amazing there. So anyways, events that we've looked at so far, Jesus is mocked and scourged by the Roman court. The Jews threaten Pilate, as we talked about. Pilate sends Jesus to be crucified. Jesus bears his cross, but becomes weak. We talked about that there's two different accounts that seem to contradict, but they don't. He didn't carry it very far, though, so they had to have Simon of Cyrene help Jesus carry the cross the rest of the way. Jesus is offered a pain medication, refuses it. He's crucified. Many mock and throw insults at Jesus, and Jesus utters final words and yields up his spirit, right? And that's kind of where we're at right now in Jesus' death. So let's take a look at John. I think I skipped something here. We want to look at Matthew chapter 27. So we go to Matthew chapter 27, verse 45, please. Can I have somebody read that? Matthew chapter 7, 45 through 56. Go ahead, Andrew. Then keep going, please, to 56. Yep, that's okay. All right, first of all, let's take a look here. It gives us a time element, right? And actually, the book of Mark gives us some exact time elements as far as how long Jesus was on the cross. But it says, now it was the sixth hour. Now, whose time system was this involved with? The Jews. It was a Jewish timekeeping system, right? The Jews had one way of keeping time. The Romans had another. The Romans looked a lot like ours, okay? Where the Jews, they divided their day from about sunrise to sunset. It was about a 12-hour period, and so they divided it up on hours there. So by when it says like the third hour, a 6 o'clock a.m. was about sunrise. So the third hour would be 3 hours past 6 o'clock. The sixth hour here would be around noon, okay? So you got 6 o'clock plus 6 hours is about noon. And darkness fell over the land at about that time. Brother Mike Franklin shared a graphic with me here, and I thought it was interesting. It's kind of blown up white a little bit and weird looking. But it shows kind of the sequence of events of Jesus. Now, keep in mind that in this day, Jesus was probably in the Garden of Gethsemane. Maybe around midnight, maybe a little bit before, a little bit after. We don't know the exact moment here. But within this entire day, all this stuff is going to happen. From the, you know, when he's drug away by this band of misfits with clubs and swords, to the point where he's in front of the Sanhedrin, to his Roman trial, to the crucifixion, to his death, and even his burial into the tomb. This all happens in this 24-hour period, as you can see here. But anyways, you can see that the crucifixion is probably about 9 o'clock based on Mark. It also says Luke here. But Mark does give us an exact time constraint that it was about the third hour is what it says in the book of Mark, right? So I'm going to go back here to our text. Let's see. So it talks about darkness falling upon the land. Now, what if some people said probably would have caused this? Atheists or people that don't believe in God, what do they say this was? An eclipse, right? They say this is an eclipse. Does anybody know the longest eclipse that's happened, solar eclipse? Now, we remember there was a solar eclipse back in August, right? So we've experienced one, and that's really cool because we can now kind of tie it in to what we read about here, right? We have some background knowledge. But what's the longest eclipse ever recorded? Yeah, 4 or 5 minutes. And I looked it up, and it says they predict one July 16th, 2186. None of us will be here on this earth at that point, but it'll be 7 minutes and 29 seconds. 7 minutes, 29 seconds. Now, what's the problem with that and what it says here in verse 45? How many hours was this in verse 45? It was sixth hour to the ninth. If I do my math correctly, it's 3 hours, right? So, that's one reason this probably wasn't an eclipse, is the length of time. Also, it says darkness fell upon how much of the land? Now, I don't know exactly the extent of the darkness. I would assume it'd be pretty broad, but you remember that eclipse back in August? In order to see the total eclipse, what did you have to do? Yeah, you had to go to Oregon or somewhere along the path that actually shot across the United States, kind of in a southeastern direction, right? The path of totality, like Don called it. But even when the sun was covered with 98% totality, that's almost all the way, right? Just a little sliver of the sun being shown. Was it still pretty light out? Yeah, it was still pretty light out, wasn't it? And so, I wasn't in the area where that happened, but I heard it was pretty light out still, even in those areas, okay? So to get darkness to fall upon the land, there's no way this could be an eclipse. It doesn't work with what the story is saying here. So I think that's proven to be wrong. Let's see here. Now, we see in verse 48, let's read that. It says, immediately one of them ran, taking a sponge, and he filled the sour wine and put a reed on it and gave him a drink. Now, one of the things about crucifixion is that you would become extremely thirsty, okay? Now, why would you become extremely thirsty? Blood loss, exactly. And so, with that blood loss, you know, you're gradually losing it. You're not replacing it. Therefore, you're getting thirsty. Your body's telling you something's wrong. You need to get this taken care of, right? So we can see some extreme thirst as Jesus is dying. In verse 51, it says, "Behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom." Now, what temple is it talking about here? Joe?
It was a Jewish temple.
Exactly. And like Joe says, it divided up the place of the holies to the most holies, right? And who could go into the place of the most holies? Only the high priest, and only one time per year, right? Was anybody else allowed in there? What would happen if they went in there? They'd die, right? And so like Joe, I never noticed that, Joe, that it was torn from top to bottom, even thinking about that. I mean, that it was miraculous it could have happened in such a way. So that's an excellent observation. I could imagine the Jews put a lot of care into what they did, right, with this whole thing. And I could imagine, like you said, that curtain wasn't a shower curtain or some cheap curtain. It was a would have been difficult to tear, especially by itself, right?
It was the height, too. Ladders, I presume they had ladders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great point. So what does this signify? Yeah, God did it for sure. It wasn't man that did this, right? What else does this show? That's what they say, exactly. It's supposed to signify that now things are opened up, right? That there's no longer the separation between man and God, essentially, right? Man being the sinners. All right, so let's go ahead and move on here. It says that in verse 53, that the tombs were open and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. Now, I never understood this completely until about a week ago here. Now, what's happening with these bodies? They've been risen. Now, are they alive at this point? Are they walking around? I always thought so. But it says, and coming out of his tombs, after the resurrection, they entered the holy city. So, you know, I don't know if the bodies just, the tombs were open, the bodies were raised up, and then they came alive once Jesus was resurrected or whatever. But it says that they didn't enter the city. You didn't see them until when? Until after the resurrection, right? After Jesus' resurrection. So they wouldn't have been walking around the city at this particular point in time. It took another couple of days for them to get there, right? So how long was it before Jesus died? I want you guys to use scriptures. Try to find that. In one of the four gospel accounts, it tells us exactly how long Jesus was on the cross. How long was he on the cross before he died? Go ahead, I'll let you guys find that. Please don't shout it out. Just raise your hand when you have an answer there. Oh, don't shout it out. Raise your hand, please. Thank you, sir. Hint, you might look at Mark. If you're, there's four different accounts, obviously, of this. And see if you can find where that's at. I just had a conversation with my principal. She watched me teach this last week, and she said I don't wait long enough for answers. She said, you need to provide your students with more wait time. So I'm practicing that here in front of you, you know. Instead of just coming up with the first answer, I'm allowing more people to think about it. It actually is an effective tool. I know I've researched it, but you forget about it sometimes because it's easy to pick that first hand. All right, Bill, do you have an answer there for us? That's a great time indicator there, but I don't think it shows the cross and how long he was on the cross before it died. This is actually one of my questions I actually had.
How long was he
Oh, sorry, yeah, Bill.
How long was he in the grave? Like you're saying, how long was he on the cross?
Oh, yeah, you're right, yeah. That would work for the grave situation question for sure, yeah. Don?
Mark.
Okay, so it was the third hour at which he was put on the cross, right? He was crucified at that moment. Which hour did he die? Around the ninth hour, right? It says right here, like Don said in verse 33, the whole until the ninth. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in loud voice, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right? So we can see, how long is that? 3 to 9. 6 hours, right? It was about 6 hours that Jesus was on the cross, and Mark tells us that. And that's what I love about the scriptures. You can look things up like this, and you can find them in there, right? These little clues. I actually, again, I never knew this until a couple of weeks ago. I always knew he was up on the cross, but I never put together how long he was on the cross, and we found that out there. So anyways, let's go over to John chapter 19. I like to read just verses 31 through 37. There's some important things here I like to take a look at. So can I get a volunteer to read verses 31 through 37 of John chapter 19? Thanks, Carl.
Therefore, because it was the preparation day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away.
All right, so what's unique about John chapter 19 verses 32 through 34? Let's take a look at those four verses here. What's unique about those four verses? John 19, 32 through 34 here.
Very descriptive.
Very descriptive, all right. What did the Jews ask the Romans to do?
Break their legs,
which I'm assuming would be all three of them up there, right? So what happens? Does something happen in that message from the time that they give it to the time that the action is taken? Yeah, right? They don't break all their legs, do they? They break the legs of the two thieves. Why? Did they break the two thieves' legs, but not Jesus' legs? Because they're still alive, right? Now, we went over last week, these Romans, they were experts at killing people, right? Experts at crucifixion. They had to be. If they were to make mistakes, what was the penalty for them?
Death.
It was death, wasn't it? They would be killed themselves, right? So it was very important they knew what to do. Plus, they had done this a few times, okay? And so they knew when somebody was dead. They could tell. So they came across the thieves, broke their legs. And why would you break somebody's legs on a cross? Why would they do that? Don? Yeah, one of the things that people do, I've heard on the cross, is you're essentially suffocating. Because I don't think you can exhale, right? Is that the one you can't do? It's really hard to exhale. So you're always in an inhaled position like this. And so in order to exhale, you have to kind of push up on your feet, which are driven into the wood by a nail, right, which is extremely painful, but it's the only way to breathe. And so they push themselves up to take that breath, and then push themselves up to take that breath. And of course, all the while, what's happening on their back that was scourged? It's being rubbed on this rough cross. This is not a smooth piece of wood that you might find at a home improvement store, right? This is a rough tree, as they speak about. And so in order to stop that process, because as we know, they could go for days like this, right? It's been known for people to be on the cross for even up to 7 days. I don't know, maybe more, but they definitely were on there for a while. So they would break their legs in order to stop that process, so they would just suffocate and they would die, right? Yeah, Jesus had already died. So what does this soldier decide to do?
Make sure,
yeah. I mean, he's dead. We know it, but I got my spear here. Now, he's up on the cross, right? So he's elevated above the soldier, and he takes his spear and he jabs it up into the side of Jesus. We don't know which side it was or anything like that. But one thing we do know is what came out of that wound that they inflicted upon Jesus. What does it say here in verse number 34 that happened when they pierced his side, Ed? What does it say came out?
Blood and water.
Now, I've heard of doctors talking about this. Now, I don't know if this in this time period they knew about this medically, okay? I don't know if this was in their medical knowledge. But these days, what does it mean when blood and water comes out of your side? Well, it means that they pierced his heart. Mm-hmm. Because there is a layer surrounding the heart, to my knowledge. It's called the pericardium or pericardium, right? And if you pierce that layer and into the heart, you're going to get these two things. And I've heard, and again, I'm not a doctor and I don't know much about this stuff, but I've heard that when blood and water comes out, it shows that you were dead, that you were already dead. Okay? Does anybody have anything else to add to that? That's about as much as I have to add. I don't know much. I don't like to talk about this stuff and I don't know much about it. Ed?
Yeah.
Anybody else have anything to say about scourging? As far as, were all people that were crucified scourged? Yeah, so that would make sense that if people weren't scourged, that they'd be able to survive longer on the cross because you wouldn't have that particular trauma. And like you said, Ed, that could kill you alone, couldn't it? That experience by itself, and it almost did kill Jesus. It almost did. God wouldn't let that happen, of course, because that wouldn't fulfill Scripture. But it almost did, because could he even carry his own cross? He couldn't, right? And so you could tell he was about at his end, and it wasn't going to take very long to finish him off, so to speak. And so he had both the scourging and the crucifixion, which was absolutely awful. So a lot of people say, this is the swoon theory, right? That Jesus just passed out. Do you think, based on your knowledge of what you're reading in the text here, that Jesus just passed out? No, he didn't just pass out, did he? There's absolutely no way from ever. What are some indicators that he didn't pass out? If somebody was to say to you, they came up and said, Jesus just passed out, and then he kind of revived himself, and then they brought him back to health or whatever, and he could walk around, you know. What if somebody tells you that? What's going to be your defense? What are you going to tell those people? What are we going to tell them?
You're in your side.
Okay. You can say, okay, you tried taking a spear too. But, I mean, there's been stories of people coming back, you know, in the morgue or whatever, you know, that they're still living or they come alive. So, I mean, I have heard stories of this, and they might tell you that. They might say, hey, and they might even bring up a particular case that this happened, right? So what are you going to say to them? How does the text here tell us that Jesus did not just pass out, that in fact he died? Linda?
In verse
15. Okay. He says, it is finished in verse 30, which I didn't put on the slide here, the verse before this passage. Very good. So Jesus says it's finished, but what else? What if he just passes out and he says it's finished? Couldn't he have done that?
He gave up
his spirit.
I mean,
but I'm looking for evidence from the text here. Let's go back to the text, to the Bible. What does it say? And that's in there too. But what if they say, you know what, they made a mistake? What else does this text say? There's a bunch of things, isn't there? It's not just one thing or another. It's a series of a bunch of different conditions that all together prove that Jesus died, right? What are some other things besides the fact that Roman soldiers are really good at killing, that he says it's finished? Karen?
Well, we've got to remember there's two.
There is, yep.
Foreknown.
Very good. The Old Testament pointing up to here, is that what you're talking about? Kind of, yep, okay. They did pierce his side. And what came out? Blood and water, again. And you can talk to a doctor, and you can see, you know, there was actually, an article in the American Medical Journal or something like that, that talked about this particular instance and what it means to have blood and water pouring out. And I think Roger Eccles was telling me about that and saying, hey, you know, I've got this great article that talks about this. But there's another evidence that happened, right? We can also see that some people had a change in heart. I want to go over to Mark chapter 15. Like Karen said, there's many other accounts of the same event. Let's go to Mark 15, verse 33. Actually, sorry, verse 39. In verse 39, when the centurion, who was standing right in front of him, saw the way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. What was the centurion doing a little bit earlier, a few hours earlier? He was crucifying. What else was he doing? Didn't it say that even the soldiers were mocking Jesus? That they were mocking him, making fun of him? If you're the Son of God, why can't you come off the cross? The chief priest said, right? It even says many were mocking him, weren't there? There are many different groups that were mocking Jesus here. And now he's changed his tune, hasn't he? I mean, hasn't his attitude turned around completely at this moment? There had to be something here that turned that attitude around, wasn't there? Because it says, the way that he breathed his last. Let me go back to the scripture here. I'm trying to find my spot. 15:39, it says, again, he went away. No, I've lost my spot completely here. Okay, I'm going to locate myself here. I just had it. 15:39? I'm in chapter 14. That's why I can't find it. That happens when you're up here sometimes. It's so crystal clear when you're sitting in your seats. Trust me, I've sat there many times. And then you come up here and it all goes away. It totally does. And this is one of those moments that's just disappearing from my mind. But it says, I just read it even to you guys. And then it disappeared. When the centurion was standing right in front of him, he saw the way he breathed his last. Do you think this guy has seen a few people die before? Again, he's done this before. He's seen people breathe their last before. But somehow the way that Jesus breathed his last, somehow he could tell he was the Son of God. So he changed his tune and he became very fearful. I think he thought that maybe God was going to bring revenge onto him or something, right? Strike him down right there on the spot. Let's look at another group here in Luke. Let's go over to Luke chapter 23, verse 48. Now, how was the crowd treating Jesus while he was on the cross? Were they very nice to him? No, they weren't. But let's look here at Luke 23, verse 48. I'll go ahead and read that. Luke 23, 48. And that reads, And all the crowds who came together for this spectacle, when they observed what had happened, began to return, beating their breasts. Okay? Now, why are they beating their breasts? Why are they doing this? What's that, Andrew? I don't think it's that. Okay, I thought I was totally wrong on my understanding of this. I thought it was the opposite, actually, right? Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah, and like you pointed out, Joel, there's a lot of groups that have changed heart. The thief on the cross, like you said, we have the centurion, we have the crowd here changing their heart too as well. Bill?
Realizes he's dead, but out of their way by not breaking his legs, they, you know, had some doubt or wanted to ensure, said that that's what would happen. But passing thing, they all were convinced that he was dead, so they didn't listen to me.
I never thought, as you were talking about it, I thought you were going to bring up this point too, that how were the people arranged on the crosses? Who was in the middle? Jesus was in the middle, right? And on either side was a thief. So what did they have to do? They had to break one thief's legs. I'm just thinking this through. Then they had to bypass Jesus, didn't they? They had to walk past him to get to the other cross. Can you guys see the providence of God in this whole thing? Like Bill's saying, I mean, why would you like not break legs because you know he's dead, but then you pierce his side just to be sure? Man.
They break his legs to be sure.
Yeah, why not?
They were convinced.
That's what the Jews told them to do anyways. I'm sure that's what their leader told them to do. But yet, they decided not to do that. Just crazy seeing the providence of God. And that's one thing, too, is that some people will say, you know what? The Jesus followers, they knew all these prophecies in the Old Testament. And so they just, like a recipe, they made sure each one was followed. And Jesus, like a recipe, he made sure each of those things was followed. So they knew these ahead of time, and they followed this sequence of events. Yet, it's not Jesus and his disciples doing most of these things, is it? It's the Jews, it's the Romans, it's people the disciples have no control over. So there's no way they can just follow a recipe. They have other people that they can't control in this whole situation. I mean, this is amazing. It really is amazing to see how this all transpires. Carl?
Well, you can't say unequivocally, but could it mine three on each?
Yeah, that's true.
We don't know that for sure.
Good point, Carl.
So, I mean,
yep.
There's some other scripture that I'm not aware of that would say that.
No, that's a good point, Carl. You're right. It could be that maybe they had a couple groups of soldiers breaking the legs over here and then they gathered together or whatever. But why wouldn't they have gone to Jesus first, you know?
Yeah,
and but Carl, I completely agree with you. That's a great point. It doesn't say, okay? Bill?
Yeah, you know, somebody or something like that.
I was going to put that up there because, a Roman spear isn't this little tiny thing, you know. It's going to, in fact, didn't somebody put their hands in Jesus' side?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so to put your hand into a wound, it's got to be pretty large, doesn't it? Andrew?
Going back to the hearts of darkness.
Yeah.
And the accompanying stuff that went along.
Uh-huh.
You know, lightning and thunder
And I wanted just to show you one more thing here before we move on to the burial of Jesus. It says, look at verse 35. This gives us some indication about who's writing this particular gospel, which we know who it was, right? But it says, and he who has seen has testified. Who are we talking about? Yeah, but why would John say third person, and he who has testified? That's just the way he talked, wasn't it? And many times in his gospel, he would talk about himself in the third person. So this is eyewitness testimony we're seeing. This isn't some guy who just heard from another guy who heard from another guy. This is a guy who firsthand saw this happening, okay, from a distance. And so firsthand eyewitness testimony that we're looking at here. So going through the events, we can see now that the Jews asked for Jesus' legs to be broken and pierced his side. And of course, they pierced his side. And Jesus, by now, he's already dead, isn't he? He's already died. Let's look at the burial of Jesus. Matthew chapter 27. Everybody go ahead and turn over to Matthew chapter 27, please. Verses 57 through 66. Can I have somebody read these, please? These verses? Somebody new, maybe? How about Sam? You want to read verses 57 through 66, please? Of Matthew chapter 27. All right, let's continue to paint the picture here. I'd like to go over to, let's see here, John chapter 19 and read verses 38 through 42, which is the another gospel account of the same thing here. I need a reader, please, for verses 38 through 42 in John chapter 19. Don't everybody volunteer at once, okay? Ed, go ahead. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
After this, Joseph of Arimathea.
All right, so we have the burial of Jesus. Who is involved in this? Who is burying Jesus according to the scripture here?
Joseph.
And then we only learn that, though, in Matthew. It's just Joseph. But there's another gentleman involved. And who is that after we read the John account? Nicodemus. And what do we know about Nicodemus? Do you remember him from earlier in the scripture? We actually studied him in this class, right? Yeah, what was the, he came to him at night too, and he had a question. What was Nicodemus' question, if we can remember that? Linda?
What must I do to be saved?
Yeah, essentially it was, what do I have to do to be saved? Or, and he asked, well, how could a guy be born again? Do I have to enter into the womb and come back out? He, again, this is one of those literal, figurative things they didn't understand, right? And so Jesus explains to him, no, that's not what I'm meaning here. But that's the Nicodemus we're talking about, right? Now, Nicodemus and Joseph, how do they know each other? How did they know each other? They were both members of the Sanhedrin or the council, right? And they were sympathetic to Jesus' cause somewhat. They weren't totally against Jesus. In fact, it says about Joseph that I don't know what, if we read it in this gospel account or was one of the other ones, but he did not consent to it. He didn't consent to the crucifixion of Jesus, okay? So he wasn't about doing that. Now, just visualize the scene, though. Here, you're Joseph and you're Nicodemus, and you have the body of Jesus, and you're wrapping it up. What would that be like if you had to do that? What would that be like? Would that be a good moment whatsoever? I mean, I could imagine wrapping anyone's body up wouldn't be a great moment. But to wrap the body of Jesus up, as they're preparing this, I mean, Jesus is right there in front of him. They're picking up his legs and his arms so they can wrap this linen around him. Imagine that scene. What a sad moment that had to be. You know, to have that happening. Linda? Yeah, at this point, is there really anybody who is totally convinced that Jesus is going to rise again besides Jesus himself? No, there's nobody convinced at this point, is there? They've all abandoned Jesus. They've gone away scared. Nobody really believes he's going to come back to life. So to Joseph and Nicodemus, this must feel like the end. Like this dude lived a great life on earth. He did some awesome, amazing miracles. And this is it, right? Because I don't think they believe that he was going to resurrect again. I really don't. Maybe they did. Doesn't say in the scripture. But I don't think with their actions and the way that we see the other people reacting that would be true, right? So let's see here. Ed, go ahead. And I'll go ahead and stop you there, but you're right. There's a lot of, this is not a very good scene for sure. I mean, for them visually to see this either. They've got a strong stomach for sure. Let's go to verse 64. It said, "Therefore give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples..." Oh, wait, I better go backwards here. They say to Pilate, "Sir, we remember..." Notice they call him sir, right? "We remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I am to rise again.' Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal away and say that to the people, 'He is risen from the dead,' and the last deception will be worse than the first." Right? So they think it's all over, don't they? The Jews? Jesus is dead. It's over. It's going to be a deception if anything else happens here. A lot of people have said this too. They've said, "Hey, the disciples carried away Jesus' body. They stole it away." And I think God knew people would ask that question, so that's why the story is here, isn't it? Now what happens? It says you have a guard. Is this just one guard? Is it one guard? No, we can see in a verse 11 of Matthew 28, it says, "Now while they were on their way, some of the guard came into the city and reported to the chief priests all that had happened." Some of the guard that was there. I mean, this a guard is like, it's one of those words you can use in a singular or a plural sense. And so we're talking not just one guy. I mean, you could probably get one guy, "Hey, look over there. You know, why don't you come with me? Walk over this way." And you could probably trick him, right? But we're talking a group of Roman soldiers here. And so it's a little bit tougher to deceive a group of soldiers, right? And the Jews were really worried about this because why? What happens if Jesus really is resurrected or they fake his resurrection? What does this do to them? What does it do to the whole story? And what does it do for you and I?
That makes them wrong.
I wish I had written the scripture down, but Paul, the apostle Paul, talked about that if it wasn't for the resurrection of Jesus, we're of all men most to be pitied, right? Thanks, Andrew. 1 Corinthians 15 is what Andrew says there. So if the resurrection doesn't happen, then we shouldn't be sitting here today. We're wasting our time. We should go home and mow our lawn or go for a hike or whatever. All the stories we just read about mean nothing unless Jesus is resurrected. And I think the Jews understand that. That's why they say the last deception would be worse than the first. How could anything get worse than Lazarus being raised from the dead, than blind men being healed, than this darkness falling over all the land, and all these people beginning to follow Jesus? How could anything be worse than that? He rises. And then guess what? Look what this does to the whole thing. It proves it all correct. And actually, next week we're going to be studying about the resurrection. I'm very excited about that. Now, just a couple more things here. Actually, that's about all I had. So that's a great segue, actually, into the next class, is that next week we are going to be talking about the resurrection. It's the final class in this overview of Christ's life, and this is completely an overview. I'll tell you what, as I've read through this to prepare for class, you know, people are always saying, "Thanks for all the work you're putting in and all that." And I appreciate that. And it is work, but I mean, I can't tell you as a teacher how edifying and uplifting it is to prepare for these classes. I think I get more out of it than anybody in the class. I think it helps me grow more as a person, you know, and it helps me realize my own faults more too, you know. But I'll tell you what, I want to go back and I want to become an expert on Jesus' life. I'm not even close right now. And I want to keep reading these Gospels. I want to keep studying more and more about what Jesus' life was, because that's what we are. We're disciples of Christ. We need to learn everything we can about his life, don't we? Everything. Everybody here can learn more. Even Andrew. And he's very smart. He knows the scripture very well. But I guarantee there's more than Andrew can learn about Jesus' life. And he would tell you the same thing, I'm sure. So, I mean, like I said, I cannot wait. But it'll be our last on the... I call it an overview again because this has not been in any sense of the word a complete description of Christ's life. So next week, we'll see you for the resurrection.